I'm cool.
Yo, Trey.
What up?
I got something to say.
Straight out of Compton. Crazy motherfucker named Ice Cube. From the gang called Niggas with Attitudes.
Here we are with the inaugural Filmcore podcast. I'm joined by my esteemed colleague Dan Carson. He teaches physics. His research is in astrophysics at UC Irvine. Dan, how are you today?
Doing quite well. Enjoying my day off. How about you?
Likewise. So many thoughts in this film. So a little background. Dan and I went to high school together and listened to a lot of NWA together while driving around the incredible suburb of Skokie, Illinois. And it's
also known as Scompton.
Yes, it is commonly known as Scompton. Everybody knows it that way. It's just as violent.
Right.
Don't look that up, though.
Don't do that.
Because it might not be true in the traditional media.
Yeah, sense of the word true, but yeah.
But if you go like look in your gut, you know, you might find the truth there, and it will tell you that that actually was the case.
Can we have, like, 5 minutes where it's just like, herp, 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 take our jobs, herp, 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 herp,
herp, herp, herp. Straight Outta Compton came out on the 14th of last month. Huge hit. So far, it is made fucking $150 million domestically and 168 worldwide total. It's probably going to make upwards of 170 in the States, and I don't know. These things don't translate as well worldwide, these kinds of movies. It's gotten great reviews, but I think as a movie, personally, I really liked it. It had a lot of cool, weird characters that you don't really see in a big Hollywood movie. This is a Universal movie. And, you know, had a lot of new actors, new faces, which is nice because you don't kind of come in with the baggage of knowing who that actor is beforehand, saying, like, oh, that's Ryan Gosling playing Easy or whatever, which would be a very interesting film. The freshness of it really happened because of the performances and the angle of the story, which is something that we haven't seen before. It is, you know, in a lot of ways a traditional, you know, rock and roll, rise and fall biopic, but it has way more to say socially than Almost Famous did. So that's my initial sort of take. Dan is even more of an NWA expert than I am. Dan, why don't you give me your take on it initially?
Okay. Yeah, everything you said is accurate. It was cool to see some, like, unknown actors. Paul Giamatti is the only one I recognize from any previous movie. So that was cool. There was definitely some, like, revisionist history going on. And as you know, Dr. Dre and Ice Cube were, like, on set pretty much every single day. They had some sort of advisory role, and I'm not sure exactly what that was. They didn't write the script or anything, but they clearly had some influence in what was emphasized and what was left out, particularly, like, with Dr. Dre, because I think he was on set kind of pushing himself or pushing his character to be made out to be a little bit more of a hero, right? So there were all kinds of things like the confrontations with Suge Knight, as well as at the beginning of the film, just some random people in the club he was fighting with, certainly, like, made him out to be kind of a tough guy, a hero, but also, like, very moral character at the same time, which isn't really true if you look up your history. I mean, he's got a record of abuse with his ex-wife, Michelet.
His ex-girlfriend, and then also that TV reporter.
Yeah, Dee Barnes. So basically, like, what happened there was she interviewed Ice Cube, and this was, like, at the time when Ice Cube and NW were feuding, and the interview was not favorable, but that's what Dr. Dre had a problem with, was just her interviewing Ice Cube in a way that was making NWA look bad. And he confronted her at some industry party.
Yeah. He smashed her head into a wall. He kicked her ribs. It's in one of the drafts, one of the earlier drafts of the script, but they did not film it, it turns out. So it is available to look at, like, sort of a summary of that scene. So it's in the LA Times.
They also make it look like Dee Barnes threw a drink on him, right? And then he assaulted her.
Dan, you're right. Dee Barnes throws her drink in Dr. Dre's face, and then he attacks her. And then it says that he's flinging her around like a rag doll while she screams, cries, begs for him to stop.
I wonder if it even happened that way. Like,
yeah, did she even do anything that like set him off?
Right. Even according to the story they're trying to tell, like, and she recently wrote an article about it. And like Gawker, the abuse of Michelet was like ongoing, and I think it was even worse than this, like from the story she told, like firing a gun at her in the house and stuff.
Dr. Dre kind of addressed this in a Rolling Stone cover story, but it wasn't really so direct.
It seems as if he didn't actually talk to Dee Barnes or Michelet directly, right? He sort of gave this almost like a press release. And then Dee Barnes wrote something about how she sort of accepts the apology.
She was saying the truth is too ugly for a general audience in her thing in Gawker.
It really just seems like a PR move on Dr. Dre's part, because it's always been known about, but it's getting more attention. He addressed this in his music a few times, like on the song Guilty Conscience with Eminem. Dr. Dre is acting as Eminem's conscience, but Eminem kind of fires back at him saying, "Why should I listen to you? You're the guy who slapped T-Barnes." I forgot the line exactly. And then it seems like it just wasn't spoken about for a really long time. But then now that the movie's coming out, he sort of has to address it. His problem is obviously with Ice Cube. She didn't say any of those things. She just sort of gave Ice Cube the platform.
So right.
If anything, he should be going out and getting into a fight with Ice Cube. But
yeah.
Yeah. Because like, the stuff Ice Cube was saying about them is totally... It was awesome, like in the song No Vaseline. Like, that's a great song. But he really took it to a whole different level. Like, you ever listen to, like, diss songs from, like, the 80s? It's like, really mild.
Yeah.
People go, like, KRS-One, you know, like, The Bridge Is Over or whatever. It's all, like, pretty mild and, like, lighthearted. So, like, Ice Cube really took it to another level with that song. I like how they showed it in the movie, too, with him listening to it. Jerry Heller getting all bent out of shape about the anti-Semitic lines. So he's, like, pretty easy on, like, MC Ren and Yella in that song. He doesn't say a whole lot about them. He does attack Eazy-E.
It's pretty violent and it's pretty raw in a way that diss songs weren't at the time.
Definitely.
The beef was between them, not between Dr. Dre and Dee Barnes, but he sort of, I guess, his abuse on her was like a conduit for his aggression. You know, they have apologized, but like they're stuck to their ways. Like in the Rolling Stone cover story, Ice Cube says he's trying to apologize for it, but it's very clunky. He says, "If you're a bitch, you're probably not going to like us. If you're a hoe, you probably don't like us. If you're not a hoe or a bitch, don't be jumping to the defense of these despicable females."
What was this?
This is in Rolling Stone. This is August 27th, 2015. This is a cover story about Ice Cube and Dr. Dre and the movie. Mm-hmm. And he says, "I never understood why an upstanding lady would even think we're talking about her."
He's gone through great lengths to make that distinction. Like on the song, "A Bitch Is A Bitch." The label does not apply to all women.
Right.
But then he goes on to say, right after that, all women have a little bitch in them. So how does he really feel?
Yeah. It's pretty rough. And it's weird that this guy is branding himself now as like a family comedian.
Yeah, you know, he didn't make that transition like super smoothly. So if you remember in like the late 90s, he was doing like some, like a lot of sci-fi movies, like Anaconda, Ghost of Mars, like stuff like that. And then his music was, he was sort of doing a little bit of the rap metal thing, collaborating with bands like Korn.
Children of the Corn was the song.
And a lot of groups were doing that at the time, like Cypress Hill was also doing that. It's a song like rock/rap superstar, depending on which version of the song.
Oh, God.
You're listening to?
I remember that song.
So I'm not sure exactly when Ice Cube's first family-friendly movie was. I never really followed that part of his career, of course.
We can say it was Are We There Yet? Yeah, that was 2005.
And it hit.
And
right.
Then he has a football movie directed by Fred Durst called The Long Shots in 2008. And he's like, you know, his daughter's football coach.
Wow, directed by Fred Durst. I mean, that's... I had no idea Fred Durst was directing movies.
You know, he directed a lot of the Limp Bizkit music videos, too. I think he directed Behind Blue Eyes. He directed Nookie. His first movie, actually, was a Jesse Eisenberg coming-of-age movie called The Education of Charlie Banks that you wouldn't really peg for Fred Durst. Anyway, so yeah, Ice Cube became family friendly, so it's strange for him to go back and explore this content and not expect some pushback when people really delve into some of the things he said and some of the things that the group did.
It's just a different time, too. Like, imagine if Dr. Dre, like, assaulted D. Barnes in, like, 2015.
Yeah.
I think he would just lose, you know, all his endorsements. It would really affect the success of the movie.
It's weird because musically they can still address stuff like this. Like, on Compton, there's a line where Eminem on the song Medicine Man, Compton's the new Dr. Dre album, sort of inspired by the movie. Eminem says, "I even make the bitches I rape come." There hasn't been a ton of pushback on that.
Well, it's always select. I mean, it's always pretty, like, selective, right?
What gets, like, sort of becomes the object of controversy?
Yeah, yeah. It is sort of weird. It seems kind of random at times, like, because you can kind of find two seemingly equivalent things, and then, like, one got a lot of attention, the other didn't.
Point is, these are flawed people making bad choices in certain respects, but the movie focuses on the social impact that the group had and the way that they brought attention to a certain universe of culture that wasn't really in the mainstream at the time, and opening the dialogue about that. So for that, you can say it has a social value, for sure.
The first time I heard the song Fuck the Police, I didn't really appreciate the context that they wrote the song in. Seeing some of the scenes they put in the movie where they're facing abuse and harassment at the hands of the LAPD, and also the Detroit cops in that one scene where they get the concert shut down in Detroit.
That's a great scene.
Yeah, it really puts it into context. If you're the average, like, suburban white kid listening to that, you might not appreciate the reasons for writing that song. Or if you just haven't really faced police abuse or harassment before. And so, of course, when we're hearing these songs at the age of 15, going to Niles North High School and living in Skokie, it seems more just like a general, like, fuck authority statement that you would hear in a lot of other music. Like, Slipknot has similar sentiments conveyed. You know, you just kind of put it in the same category, really, I mean, at that time. But now it's like, yeah, well, it's a very different thing with, like, Corey Taylor saying in his music and what Ice Cube is saying in his music. So
Corey Taylor is just, you know, like a meth addict from Iowa.
Right, right.
His perspective is different. In this Rolling Stone article, in this cover story, Ice Cube talks about how, you know, when he's 9 or 10, the LAPD would, you know, pull him off his bike, make him put his hands on the hood of their cars. They're just playing football, but they just sort of, like, they'll just search him. You know, just they'll just sort of keep them intimidated and just sort of cultivate this atmosphere of fear. Yeah, so it's scary. It's interesting how the movie takes that song, Fuck the Police, and then the Rodney King trial happens, and there's the fallout from that when the policemen that beat Rodney King are let off the hook by an all-white jury.
The riots were sparked by the acquittal, not the original beating.
Exactly. And so there's a really great shot in the movie when they have the two big rival gangs of LA, the Crips and the Bloods, they have their colors in bandanas tied together, and they're sort of holding one in each hand and approaching this battering line of cops with batons out in slow motion. It's a really good shot.
And the riot here on?
Yeah, it's just crazy how it happened, and it's crazy how the song becomes a rallying cry for this community and this cause. And I think that is the way to approach the movie, not for what it doesn't talk about as much as what it does, because at least it's talking about something. And it's a major movie. It has something to say. Other movies don't even have speaking roles for people of color beyond a beat cop. So it's nice to see that side of the country represented and talked about.
So remember how they left the tape, the Bone Thugs tape, at the hospital with Eazy-E?
Yeah.
I wanted him to put the tape in and then, like, hear the song Crossroad playing and have a tearful montage.
That would be too sad. I don't know.
I know, but I was expecting it. Because that would be the perfect song.
So Eazy-E was on their first single, For the Love of Money. You know, he found them, he discovered them. So it's kind of like a nice way to sort of show that his legacy lives on in music. So from even after he died, he had an influence on where rap was going. So I think that's a good idea. It's like the way they had Tupac in the studio recording a song from All Eyes on Me.
Yeah.
I my big thing with the treatment of Eazy-E getting HIV is that it has his relationship with his wife, Tamika Wright. It all happens very suddenly. All of a sudden, she's there, and they're married.
Right.
And they're working on their finances, and she's, like, an expert in accounting. She's also a producer. So, basically, Dr. Dre, Ice Cube, and Tamika Wright are producers on the movie. MC Ren and DJ Yella are not. They were apparently all there on the set every day, the three of them. So, obviously, you can feel her influence. But it is strange that Eazy-E goes from having, you know, Eazy-E's Wet and Wild pool parties and being addressed as the sort of Lothario by Paul Giamatti and Ice Cube and Dr. Dre a bunch of times in the movie. And there's a scene, too, in a hotel where we see him getting oral sex from a married woman. And he goes from that to being, you know, this monogamous, straight-laced guy, just sort of dealing with basic domestic things like, you know, handling money with his wife.
Do you think they implied he was being monogamous at the time? I mean, just because they didn't show the groupies during this that part of the movie. I mean,
I guess you have a point. My thing is just like, I don't know. Where does this relationship come from? How does he feel about her? Like, that isn't really addressed.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe that's something they'll have in the director's cut.
Yeah, right. It was originally 3.5 hours long, the movie. And even now it's like, it's 2.5.
I almost would rather have had some of that backstory in there. Like, just focus in a little bit more on the NWA characters. Because I feel like they had some just unnecessary scenes, like introducing Snoop Dogg. And the Tupac thing was cool, but I felt like they just did it so... just because they had felt like obligated to include them in the movie. Even though they didn't have much to do with the actual story. Well, yeah, okay. In the end credits, they do some Beats advertising, right? I don't know if you stuck around for the end credits.
Oh, I did.
Dr. Dre can't do anything without advertising Beats. It's like in his appearances on Good Kid, Mad City, he drops a few references to Beats in the song Compton, right?
Yeah, yeah, the title song on, yeah.
He's really heavily promoting that stuff. I wasn't expecting to see that at any point.
You know, also in the end credits, they talk about what Dre and Ice Cube have done since, you know, and their success. And Eazy-E's, how his death, you know, affected so many people. And you got, there were like 2,300 people at this sort of, this wake for him, like this public wake. You know, what about MC Ren? What about DJ Yella? Like, you know, you were telling me before we started this podcast that you were annoyed that they didn't really get enough focus. And it's true, like, Suge Knight was a bigger character than both of those guys. I mean, they were there more than him, like, they had more screen time, but you really got a sense of Suge Knight's personality in a way that you didn't with Ren and Yella.
That's the thing, is those are the only two that didn't go on to do huge things after NWA. So, like, you know, DJ Yella became a porn director, and that's pretty much all he's been doing for, like, the last 25 years.
Yeah, Rolling Stone said that he produced over 300 pornographic movies.
Hey, what if instead of talking about Dr. Dre moving on to, like, these different record labels and starting his own company, in the end credits, they should have talked about all the porn movies that DJ Yella made.
And shown them.
Yeah, yeah, like, showing scenes from them. Like different titles. What can you pull up some of the titles of DJ Yella's porn movies?
Let's do that. Here's one: Hoes with Attitude, HWA, Hoes with Attitude.
He's really playing up the former NWA member aspect of this.
There's one called Triple X Games, but that was before Ice Cube was in Triple X State of the Union in 2005.
Okay, then, and then MC Ren, like what? He did keep releasing albums, but very sporadically, so it didn't seem like as much of a serious career for him afterwards. Because I think he was really really disillusioned by the dealing with the music industry.
Well, first let me say, so MC Ren had 4 albums. He has had 4 albums to date as a solo artist. He has 2 EPs.
But that's over the course of like 25 years.
And NWA officially, I think, broke up in 92. Their last album was...
I think it was 91.
Yeah, the last album was 91. It's a name that we can't say.
You can say it backwards, which is how it's given on the cover.
Yeah, on the cover it's FL4Ziggen. Right?
Right.
Right. So you guys figure that out.
For four straight out of Compton, they had this album called NWA and the Posse. But that was before they really had a solid group lineup, and the style was a lot different. And some of the same songs that you hear on Straight Outta Compton are on this NWA and the Posse album, but they're just earlier versions of those songs. Like, and Boys in the Hood is on there too. And then it has features by a bunch of rappers that, you know, no one ever heard from again. It's really just like a compilation album.
They have Dope Man on there too. They have 8-Ball. Yeah. All the songs are produced by Dr. Dre. I guess you have to count that. Okay, so technically N.W.A. then had three studio albums and then the one extended play, 100 Miles and Running. Oh, so the big thing with MCRM too, though, is that he's sort of set up as the next lyricist, right? The next sort of the main rapper after Ice Cube leaves.
Keep in mind, he's, you know, Eazy-E is not writing his own lyrics.
Right.
At least at this point. I'm not sure if he started writing his own lyrics later on, but while he was with N.W.A., it was Ice Cube was writing it, and then MCRM became the writer.
Right. And Eazy-E, like, is famous as being one of the best rappers ever, mainly because of his flow, the way he sounded when he rapped their rhymes, but he was not the writer.
It's just his voice.
Yeah. It's cool.
He's got a very unique voice.
Yeah, the sort of high-pitched, nasally thing. And he's a little guy, so it makes sense that he has that. But he's just, like, the attitude of it was really cool. And it turns out Dr. Dre never wrote his own lyrics, too, which I did not know. But Ice Cube and MC Ren wrote and continue to write most of his lyrics. His flow isn't as great, but mainly, you know, his contribution is as a producer and a recognizer of talent. Dr. Dre, in the movie, is shown as the guy that tells Eazy-E, you should do Boys in the Hood, after the group from New York decides not to. But yeah, Dan, just talk a little bit about MC Ren and how he is as a rapper, what you thought of him. You're big on MC Ren, right?
Yeah, I think he's really underrated, and he definitely didn't get enough screen time. And also, I think out of all the members of the group, for the most part, they got actors that were pretty spot on in terms of their appearance. I mean, obviously, Ice Cube's son looks a lot like Ice Cube.
Yeah, O'Shea Jackson Jr.
But MC Ren was the only one where the actor didn't really look that much like MC Ren.
He looks a lot like Bulls rookie Bobby Portis, actually. That would be the closest celebrity comparison, I would say, for that guy.
Yeah, so he can appear in the Bobby Portis biopic when that comes out.
Yeah. Well, he's going to be like a 12-time All-Star, so Hall of Famer. He's going to win us like 5 championships, so, you know, I think that will happen. And we will see that biopic very soon. So that actor is named as Aldis Hodge. He's been acting since he was a kid. He was in Die Hard with a Vengeance, apparently. He would have been 8 when they filmed it. So he's been in 2 Die Hard movies, which is as many as Bonnie Bedelia has been in. Bonnie Bedelia plays Mrs. McLean. Side note. Anyway, let's go on.
Anyway, MC Ren, very underrated, and I guess didn't get enough screen time, but I actually just don't know a lot about MC Ren's backstory.
And they don't talk about it in the movie. He's just there.
Yeah, and it wasn't addressed in the movie either. So, I mean, I get it. It makes sense. They're sort of, you know, weighting how much screen time people get based on, like, their overall impact and legacy. Clearly, like, MC Ren and DJ Yella didn't have as much of a legacy as the other members.
Yeah. He and Eazy-E were part of the same crew. They both ran with the Kelly Park Compton Crips. And so that was his connection, I think, to the group.
Right. You didn't see any scenes with MC Ren at home arguing with his mom or on the school bus. So he was one of the younger members, just like Ice Cube. He must have been in high school at the time.
Yeah, he was born in 69. Ice Cube was also born in 69. They're actually very close in age. They're one day apart. Ren was born June 14th. Ice Cube was born June 15th, 1969. Fun fact.
I want to talk about how Yella was a goofy guy. You know, he was like the comic relief. That had to have been true.
He looks like I don't know. I mean, he's, you know, he's the porn guy, right? He seems like kind of the character of the group in some ways. Eazy-E and Yella, you would think, have like the most interesting personalities. And in the movie, it's like, you know, Dr. Dre and Ice Cube are like the, and Eazy are like the emotional centers, but like Dre and Cube are sort of stoic and intense. And, you know, Yella an easier, like, a little more lively, kind of, in some ways.
Yeah, just, or Yella was just a goofy guy. He was always joking around, and I like how he was just totally not offended by no Vaseline. He was just sitting there laughing while everyone else was fuming.
Right, that was kind of cool. I like that he appreciated the quality of the dish.
Right, right. It was just fun for him.
He's played by a guy called Neil Brown Jr., who is in The Fast and the Furious 4, which is called Fast and Furious, from '09. And he's in Never Back Down, Battle Los Angeles. He's in an episode of CSI Cyber, that new show, with Patricia Arquette. So that guy's more of a known commodity than Aldis Hodge.
Hodgepodge.
Yeah, so I agree. I thought he was an interesting character, and I would have liked to see more of him. He's pretty fun, too, in the early scenes when they're sort of coming up with their buddy Alonzo beginning there.
Yeah, so how much older is that guy Alonzo than them? I wonder how they ended up in a group together.
He's nearly a full decade older, is what the Rolling Stone article says.
Right. Initially, he was just bossing them around. His musical style was just completely different. He was into... He basically wanted them to make a bunch of slow jams.
Like Dr. Dre was initially...
Because they were using his studio.
Right, like, yeah, yeah.
Alonzo's studio to record the first batch of songs. Like, and then they moved to a different studio to record straight out of Compton.
Yeah, after Jerry Heller.
Once they were along with Jerry Heller. But those first couple singles, like Boys in the Hood, that was recorded in Alonzo's studio. At least that's what the movie says. So he was there giving his input, and he just did not like the direction they were taking things in at all.
He's very much into, like, old-school R&B. Well, not old-school now, not at the time. It was, you know, the mid-80s. Yeah. There was a lot of, like, slow jams.
It was also very electronic, though. It was, like electro music infused with R&B.
Like Zap. Yeah. Zap was, like, a big... There's some Zap songs on there.
Right. Which are awesome.
Zap is amazing. Computer Love and I Want to Be Your Man. They do sound exactly the same, but they're great. Computer Love is sampled by Tupac in a song called Thug Passion, which is a fantastic song.
And Roger Troutman, with his talk box, has been just featured on like tons of West Coast rap songs throughout the years. Like, he did California Love as well.
That's the thing, too. The soundtrack is like... I'm sort of a sucker for really, really good soundtracks. So I really love the James Brown movie, and I'm not sure how much of that was influenced by the incredible soundtrack because, you know, man, is it good. And the same thing with this movie. It's like it has those songs too, right? So it has old school R&B, and it has old school gangster rap and more contemporary, like 90s gangster rap, which I guess is still pretty old school now. But it's very different sound in terms of the production and the samples chosen for the late 80s stuff and the mid-90s stuff that ends the movie. And they're both awesome. So it's really cool to sort of have everything like that in the soundtrack. And they play a lot of the songs a couple of times, especially like the big hits. Like Straight Outta Compton and Fuck the Police are played multiple times, and Boys in the Hood. The coolest thing, I think, actually about that is the bass is really emphasized in a way that it's not on the actual recorded versions of the songs. I'm sure that's an influence of Dr. Dre, because Beats by Dre is very much bass-oriented in terms of the mixing of those headphones and the compression. It's really cool to hear the songs that way. It makes them more powerful, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a generational thing. I think, like, if you're, you know, if you grew up listening to, like, Led Zeppelin albums, you would hate the way albums are mixed and mastered these days. Maybe some old school people prefer the older version.
But for hip hop, I think having a heavy bass really sells things.
Oh, yeah.
So the NWA album Straight Outta Compton, the first album from 88, it re-entered the Billboard 200 on its 27th anniversary that week, selling 12,459 album equivalent units. And it hit number 30 on the Billboard charts.
So here's the way they calculate this. So now 10 digital track sales from an album are equivalent to an album sale.
Oh, okay.
So that's kind of weird, right? So it could just be 10 different people just downloading the one most popular single from the album, or it could be people just purchasing the whole album. And also 1,500 song streams from an album will equate to one album sale. So they are accounting for streaming, and it actually doesn't say here like which streaming services are included in this, but I got to imagine things like Pandora and Spotify, possibly SoundCloud, are included in the streaming information.
Right. It's so hard to aggregate cumulative like album units now because of the different sort of avenues that people can listen to stuff. I don't know, because I feel like people are listening to more music than ever in a way, but they're not paying for it.
They're paying for it less than ever, yeah.
I think a lot of music fans listen to Spotify and like pay for the premium service. I know I do. And I will buy albums on occasion, but I can't say I do it all the time or even that often.
Yeah, artists really get fucked up with the streaming. I mean, they make no money off of streaming off Spotify or Pandora. We should talk about Suge Knight at some point. He's just a bad guy. He's been known to run his record label with sort of an iron fist. This is even addressed in some of the music at the time. One thing they actually left out was like how Eazy-E and Dr. Dre were going back and forth on tracks, dissing each other. So on The Chronic, Dr. Dre has several songs that are just aimed at Eazy-E, like Dre Day, and Bitches Ain't Shit is actually about, it's not about women, it's about Eazy-E. It's a diss to him. They were going back and forth, but on one of Eazy-E's songs, Real Motherfucking G's, he says, "I hear at death row you're getting treated like boot camp." And he's referencing the fact that Suge Knight would routinely just beat the shit out of people who worked at Death Row Records, including the artists and people in the studio. So that's how he ran things around there. And as we know, he also used violence to get people to sign contracts or opt out of contracts in a way that would be favorable to his business. One thing, I wish they showed this too. Suge Knight, he was working on behalf of some client who stood to make some money from the song Ice Ice Baby by Vanilla Ice. And, right. So it was someone involved in making that song who felt like he was owed some royalties now that the song was getting so huge. And so Suge Knight had to go to Vanilla Ice to get him to sign some paperwork. It's not funny when you think about it, but it's sort of funny because it happened to Vanilla Ice. So
right. Rob Van Winkle, man. Rob Van Winkle.
Yes, Robert Van Winkle.
Robert.
very interesting. Ice Ice Baby was this huge song, making a lot of money. And one of Suge Knight's clients, and I don't know in what capacity he was a client, maybe, you know, because Suge Knight was also just a bodyguard, so. But in any case, Suge Knight had his own music publishing company, and his client, Mario Johnson, felt he was owed royalties from the song Ice Ice Baby, because he wrote some of the song. I'm not sure if that's the lyrics or making the beat or whatever. Suge Knight's coming after Vanilla Ice for royalties. And basically, Suge Knight just wants Vanilla Ice to sign over the rights to the royalties to this other guy. And so he's actually sort of harassing Vanilla Ice, you know, showing up at the same restaurants and just kind of intimidating him. But then at one point, Suge Knight and his crew bust into Vanilla Ice's hotel, which is like a high-rise hotel and it has a balcony. And Suge Knight dangles Vanilla Ice by his ankle over the balcony. And that's how he gets him to sign the rights over to the song. To sign the royalties over. That's the kind of thing he would do. And as we saw in the movie, he would also... He basically had Eazy-E beat up to get him out of, or to get Dr. Dre out of his contract with Ruthless Records so he could go over to Death Row.
Yeah, by like four guys, four huge, scary guys in a recording studio.
Right.
And then he also terrifies Jerry Heller a couple of times with just, like, people outside of his apartment and stuff. And at one point, Jerry Heller, like, starts carrying a gun. So they do go into that. They also have a scene at Death Row. There's a couple of scenes where just, like, Suge Knight is out of control at Death Row. But there's one where there's a guy in just his underwear being attacked by a dog until he shows the proper amount of respect, I guess, to Suge Knight. Dr. Dre breaks it up heroically.
So I wasn't there, of course, but, like, do you really think that Dr. Dre stood up to Suge Knight in that way? Do you think he got in his face? He actually assaulted one, you know, in the movie, punched Suge Knight's, like, friend, who's also, you know, in the movie they depict all his friends as being Bloods. So basically, you're just in this room full of Bloods, and you just punch Suge Knight's friend in the face, you know, and then you stand up in Suge Knight's face and start screaming at him. Like, that kind of seems a little far-fetched given what we know about Suge Knight. I mean, like, why wouldn't Dr. Dre have been getting the same treatment that everyone else was getting at the time? You know what I mean?
In the movie, it sort of depicts them as partners, and Dr. Dre sort of is the guy that gets Suge Knight in the door. Suge Knight and the DOC sort of are each other's way in via Dre. The movie implies that there's, like, a respect between Suge Knight and Dre, you know, because they really are partners at Death Row.
When it comes down to it, like, that's the thing. Like, can Dr. Dre use violence and intimidation against Suge Knight? I don't know. That's what seems far-fetched. Dr. Dre left with nothing. Presumably, he should have gotten some money. It's sort of like a severance package. If he really left with dignity, like they show in the movie, why didn't he get any money out of it?
Right. In the movie, it's just like, oh, like, I don't care about the money, you know.
Yeah, but Dr. Dre does care about the money.
Yeah, because everything he talks about mentions how rich he is off of beats. The Rolling Stone article...
Yeah, so it's hard to believe that he could just leave without caring about the money.
Yeah, in the Rolling Stone article, he literally says, I'm not a billionaire yet, man. I will be hopefully one day. But let me tell you something. I never have to make another dollar in this lifetime. So
yeah, did he leave because he felt threatened? And, like, that Suge Knight was just going too crazy?
Yeah.
That's the thing. Suge Knight is just a scary guy. I mean...
And that comes across in the movie. That actor was really good.
No problems with that. I guess it's just the way Dr. Dre seemed to interact with him. Do you think there's a little revisionist history going on there?
Yeah.
We can only speculate about this, but it just doesn't... It seems a little fishy, and it's not the only way where Dr. Dre is portrayed as sort of heroic in a way that seems a bit fishy.
And that actor's name is R. Marcos Taylor, by the way. Suge Knight guy. He's really good. I agree. At the same time, though, like, all this said, you know, we can nitpick the factuality of it, but, you know, every movie that's based in real life takes some creative liberties with history. You know, there's a lot of, like, time compression, there's a lot of, you know, characters sort of being marginalized because you only have so much time. Of course, that being said, it does seem like Yella and Ren were marginalized unfairly, and too much screen time was allotted to people like Snoop Dogg, like you say, and the DOC, even. I agree with you there. But, like,
at least the DOC had, like, he was on one of the tracks on Straight Outta Compton. He had more direct involvement.
But Snoop Dogg is basically, like, all over the Chronic, Dre's 92 solo album, which is, you know, a classic of West Coast hip-hop. And it's basically like a duets album between the two of them. Like, they're all over it. It's not just Dre.
Yeah.
I agree that Dre is probably more the hero of the story than he should be. And there's this whole arc with his little brother and with his family, with his mom, him being arrested a couple of times in the movie. He goes to jail during the movie, but they don't show it. They show him getting arrested in a high-speed car chase after a high-speed car chase. It's a pretty cool scene, too. It's well shot and it's fun. But they don't show the supposed transition that he undergoes in prison that inspires him to sort of become his own man, leave Death Row, start Aftermath, all that stuff, which he addresses in the Rolling Stone article, but is sort of glossed over in the movie.
So, like, almost everything he's ever done is, like, pretty critically acclaimed. But some of the very first Aftermath releases, not so much. Do you remember the song he made for the movie Friday, Keep Their Heads Ringing? It's got a good beat, but some of the stuff he's saying is really goofy.
I would concur.
Cavity creeps and stuff. Talking about cavity creeps.
Paul Giamatti, he has the weirdest wig in this movie. It's so fake looking. So incredibly fake looking. Especially when you know what his real hairline is.
Yeah, but like maybe Jerry Heller wore a hairpiece and that's what they're trying to show. I don't know.
So it is in the style of Paul Giamatti's hair. It's just like they put the widow's peak too far forward and it looks super artificial for Jerry Heller, who's supposed to be an older guy anyway. You know, like there's no reason for his hair to be that far forward.
I gotta say, I didn't notice this at all.
As a person with follicular troubles, I think I'm just very attuned to people's wigs. Let me just go through some movie stuff with it real fast. So the movie, it's gotten, you know, 90% Rotten Tomatoes rating. And you can't always trust critical aggregate sites. But I think they're onto something in this case. It's really, really like a good-looking movie. Well-paced for the most part, with exception paid to those annoying sort of the stuff where they digress and they sort of throw in Tupac and Snoop. Those are not really super necessary, but sort of their ascent through like the local club scene to the Jerry Heller signing to them blowing up and finding their voice to the issues with cops both at a local and national level. All that stuff is really well handled, and the way the role they play in the Rodney King fallout response, how they become, you know, sort of the voice of that movement in certain respects. But all that stuff is handled really well. It's paced pretty well, and you know, it's a drama mostly. You know, it's got all the crazy groupie scenes and the drugs and stuff, and it doesn't totally sugarcoat Ice Cube. It has Ice Cube be less than civil. There's one point where he kicks out a groupie kind of violently. And then there's another scene where he intimidates a record producer because he thinks he should have gotten paid better, a better royalty advance on his second album than he got, because America's Most Wanted, his first solo album, was a huge hit. And so he like takes a baseball bat to the guy's office and just like wreaks havoc. The second album is Death Certificate. He wanted a bigger advance on Death Certificate. Anyway, eventually he got it. The movie does a pretty good job of tying all the stories together. F. Gary Gray, the director, who also directed Friday, and directed The Italian Job with Mark Wahlberg, which is a really good action movie. He has a really good sort of command of the camera. I think that's important. My favorite scenes visually are the Detroit concert scene, where they play Fuck the Police after being told not to. It starts with like a close-up of the cop, and then it gets to a wide shot of like to the chief of police basically at the concert venue saying, you know, what they can't do. And then it gets into like coverage of the band on the stairs and then coverage of all the cops behind him. And then it goes to the concert and then it has all these like plainclothes policemen storming the stage. And there's like gunshots and there's a lot of like cool crane shots, overhead shots. You know, the bass is very heavy in the mix, like I was saying. So that whole scene's really done well in all levels as a movie scene. And then I think the introduction of Dr. Dre is really cool. Like, there's this cool overhead shot of him listening to some old records on headphones, and it sort of comes in from this, there's like a lens flare, and it sort of pans from his record collection onto his face, and then he gets woken up by his mom. And anyway, I think that's a really cool sequence, and I think F. Gary Gray and his cinematographer, Matthew Libatique, do a good job of sort of making the movie less than like your typical VH1, you know, TV movie or something like that. It really feels like a theatrical feature film, which is really cool. It's cool that it has the scope visually to match the aspirations of the music, you know, and the bigness of the music. We should say, I think O'Shea Jackson's really good, especially O'Shea Jackson Jr., who is Ice Cube's son, and I think the Eazy-E guy is really spot on. So the Eazy-E guy, who is Jason Mitchell, he's really good. He's really good. I don't know, the Jerry Cole, the whole look of him is really cool. He can really do a lot, I think. I believe him more than I believe, like, Corey Hawkins, who's Dr. Dre. But Dr. Dre, he's really good, too. But I think Jason Mitchell and O'Shea Jackson Jr. are, like, the standouts.
I'd have to agree.
I think that it's a really good movie. It, like we both sort of established, it glosses over some kind of important historical things that hold it back from being a great movie. It's weird because maybe out of context, if you just take it for what it is, it's probably better than it is when you know some of the realities of what some of these guys did. It's a little long. There's too many supporting characters that don't really need to be there for the narrative, but it's also really cool, and it's a cool story, and it's a cool new angle that we don't see a lot in big movies.
And
did you hear that?
There's talk of a yeah.
The laughter and shit.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, they're playing. Where's that coming? They're playing Madden, and they're super drunk, probably.
Oh, okay. There are talks of a sequel, I believe, right?
There's talks of like spin-offs and movies inspired by different people.
Because there's a lot of other ground they can cover. I'd actually like to see a movie that goes into the Death Row story.
Me too.
With the same guy who plays Suge Knight. Pretty much all the same actors, if they could make that happen. What's the scoop on the sequel?
According to the Hollywood Reporter, Welcome to Death Row, based on a book and a documentary of the same name, is being shopped around. It would follow like the time after NWA was formed. Ice Cube has said that he might be interested in making that happen. So S. Lee Savage, who wrote the book and made the documentary, and also received the story and co-executive producer credit on Straight Outta Compton, the movie, is the guy that's shopping it around. There's also a Tupac movie that's coming from Morgan Creek with this guy called Carl Franklin signed on to direct it, who directed Out of Time with Denzel Washington, Devil in a Blue Dress with Denzel Washington, One True Thing randomly with Meryl Streep where she's dying. Anyway, so he's a working director, basically. He hasn't directed anything amazing. But yeah, so he's directing this Tupac movie. So we've got a Tupac movie and a Death Row movie possibly on the horizon.
I'd like to see that.
Yeah, I'd love to see both of those if they're done like this was done. It'd be great to see more stuff like this. And while it's flawed, it's really good. And it's worth seeing and worth talking about. There you have it. A long, long piece on how worth your time the movie is without being quite awesome. But pretty darn good all the same. Dan, thank you so much for joining us for this inaugural podcast, and I cannot wait to discuss Tupac the movie when that comes out with you, and Welcome to Death Row when that comes out.
Yeah.
Woke up quick at about noon, just thought that I had to be in Compton soon. I gotta get drunk before the day begins, before my mother starts bitching about my friend.